Thank you. We're very much aware in this last panel that we're standing between you and the reception. So we wanted to at least begin as soon as possible so that we don't hold you up anymore. I'm Todd Gazziano, and I have the great good fun to work with Ed on a regular basis at the Heritage Foundation, but I won't say anything more about what we do there, except that we also support the Federalist Society. I never get flack from Ed Meese when I want to go to a Federalist Society conference or speak at a law school on behalf of the Federalist Society. And as a matter of fact, earlier this year, I attended a similar panel discussion at the Federalist Society's Faculty Division Conference, and there Professor Randy Barnett related that the liberal constitutional scholar Jack Balkin had just come out of the closet. Yes, Balkin had admitted that he is now an originalist. This is what Balkin's forthcoming article in Constitutional Commentary will say, quote, "Constitutional interpretation requires fidelity to the original meaning and principle that underlie the text. The task of interpretation is to look to the original meaning and underlying principle and decide how best to apply them in current circumstances. I call this the method of text and principle." He has to give it a funny name. We've been giving it a lot of names for 20 years. Well, the optimist Randy Barnett at that conference, in his own and in his own forthcoming article on Balkin's conversion in Constitutional Commentary. Remember, they're having an edition of this journal to talk about this sort of conversion. To quote Randy Barnett, "This is big." Well, Mike Rappaport was on the panel with Randy Barnett, and he seemed a little less certain about the Balkin's brand of originalism, but even he seemed to admit that the originalist cause has changed in the years since Ed Meese started the great debate in 1985 and 1986. And so now we're going to turn to these three distinguished scholars to bring us up to date. Most of you know at least two of these three Californians. I don't know how I got on the non-California panel, but Mike Rappaport is the university professor of law at the University of San Diego Law School. His CV says he teaches an impressive number of subjects, including administrative law, advanced constitutional law, constitutional history, legislation, insurance law, and environmental law. I think he rolls a dice probably as to what he teaches, maybe not. But I think he is going to focus on the intellectual developments on originalism in the academy. Dan Lowenstein is a professor of law at UCLA Law School, and he also teaches an eclectic range of subjects as well, including election law, statutory interpretation and legislative process, political theory, and law and literature. And on another day, I think we would be most interested in particular his artistic endeavors and as they relate to the law. But for today, I think we've asked him to talk about how some of the intellectual currents involving originalism have affected the field of statutory interpretation. John Yu is a professor of law at Bolt Hall School of Law in Berkeley. And your CV, John, doesn't list all the things you teach. But it certainly has an impressive list of other academic institutions and government posts that you've taught at, as well as, of course, we're interested in how you've applied your originalist approach in your last two books to the doctrines of or the powers of war and peace. And I hope that you'll also focus, since you were a senior attorney in all three branches of the federal government, to describe for us, if you think, as a practical matter, originalism is practiced in government. So with that, I'd like to ask Mike to begin.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Before I start, I just want to say I spent 3 years in the Justice Department, in the Meese Justice Department, and I just want to say what a great time that was. I had graduated from Yale Law School, and coming to the Meese Justice Department was just an unbelievably eye-opening experience. just that's really where I learned law. That's learned about the separation of powers, learned about the rule of law, and learned about originalism. And in a lot of ways, we knew at the time how fortunate we were to be in the Mies Justice Department. And to, so it's just a great thing to be able to celebrate this now, some years down the road. Anyway, today I'd like to talk about two aspects of originalism. First, I want to speak a bit about the development of modern originalism since the time Attorney General Mies gave his famous speech to the ABA in 1985. And then I'd like to present a new justification for originalism. So let me start with Attorney General Mies' speech to the APA, which was really of enormous importance at the time. While originalism had some academic defenders and they were sort of out there, Attorney General Mies' speech really brought it into the public eye. The speech prompted responses from a variety of people, including two Supreme Court justices, Justice Brennan, Justice Stevens. After that speech, originalism really began to take off, and Attorney General Mies and President Reagan appointed Justice Scalia to the court shortly thereafter. Justice Scalia, obviously a strong originalist and really one of the intellectual leaders of the originalist movement. The Scalia appointment is eventually followed by Clarence Thomas's appointment, another strong originalist. And with the two most recent appointments of John Roberts and Sam Alito, there's a good chance now that we have four strong originalists on the Supreme Court, which is really saying something. Now, one more action of Attorney General Mies regarding originalism deserves some discussion. That's the nomination of Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Now, in one sense, I think one might regard the Bork nomination as a disaster for originalism. And so it was in the short term. But in the long run, I think maybe, you know, there's a way of thinking about this that's a bit more optimistic, a way of thinking about it sort of almost by analogy to Barry Goldwater's failed presidential bid in 1964. And like the Goldwater loss, the rejection of Judge Bork ultimately energized the originalist movement, you know, giving them something to fight for, making clear the effort that was required, and some of that has really happened. And so maybe there's a way of thinking about the Bork nomination which has a sort of slightly happier face on it. Well, while originalism has been growing in the courts, it's also been developing in the academy. Since Attorney General Mies' speech, the number of originalist law professors has grown dramatically. And actually, a fair number of those law professors served in the Justice Department under Attorney General Mies. Now, originalist law professors have spent considerable time sort of developing the theory of originalism. And I think in at least one area, several actually, but let me talk about one area, they made considerable progress. So when Attorney General Mies gave his speech, he talked about the jurisprudence of original intention. But these days, originalists tend to talk about the original meaning of the document, the focus being on how a reasonably well-informed person at the time would have understood its words, which actually I think ends up being an important change, although it doesn't seem like all that much maybe when you just use the term, but it's a significant improvement. On another issue, however, how we justify originalism, there continues to be strong disagreement on matters. And one view associated with Justice Scalia and Judge Bork holds that the reason why we should be originalists, or the main reason, is that it's necessary to constrain judges. That if judges are largely free to do what they want, essentially that's going to usurp democratic decision-making. It's going to deprive the public of notice of what the law is. And while I think there's a lot to be said for this kind of view, there's one at least significant problem with it, which is if we have a bad constitution, if the constitution contained undesirable provisions that were really problematic, the fact that originalism constrains judges and it makes for clear rules would seem like small comfort. Right? Today I want to provide a different justification for originalism that I believe avoids this drawback. And this justification, I should say, is developed by John McGinnis and myself in a couple of papers in recent years. John, by the way, also served in the Mies Justice Department at the Office of Legal Counsel. Now, under our justification, it's not merely that originalism constrains judges. Rather, it's that originalism is likely to lead to better results than alternative interpretive methodologies, including methodologies like the Living Constitution, interpretation based on the Living Constitution. And the reason for this is that the Constitution was enacted through strict supermajority rules that made it likely that the Constitution itself would be a desirable document. Thus, if we simply enforce the original Constitution as it was written, we're actually likely to get good results. We don't have to choose between constrained interpretation and good results. Originalist interpretation of a Constitution enacted through supermajority rules should give us both. Okay, well, let me summarize my argument in three steps, and then I'll discuss each of them a bit more in a bit more detail. So first, so I'll give it out to you for three, and then first, the enactment of a constitution under appropriate supermajority rules is likely to lead to desirable provisions, provisions that protect individual rights, that protect democratic decision-making, that promote the public interest. Second, the supermajority rules that govern the enactment of the Constitution, right? In order to get the Constitution enacted, you needed to have a supermajority of the states ratify it. In order to amend the Constitution, you need a supermajority of the states to approve it and to supermajority of the Congress in order to propose the amendment. So these supermajority rules that govern the enactment of the Constitution and its amendment are in the main appropriate supermajority rules, so it's no surprise that we end up having a desirable constitution. And finally, in order for the Constitution to have this desirable character produced by a supermajority rule, it's necessary to give it its original meaning, because that's the meaning that the drafters and the ratifiers used when deciding whether to enact the Constitution through those supermajoritarian processes in the first place. Okay, well, let me talk a bit more about some of this. The first point is that appropriate supermajority rules are likely to produce desirable constitutional provisions. And I don't really have time to give you the full argument. It involves models and the like, so let me just give you a flavor of the argument. And I think the easiest way to see it is to think about the difference between majority rule and supermajority rule. Now, while enacting a constitution, entrenched constitutional provisions, through majority rule would not be a good idea, enacting it through a supermajority rule is a good idea, is likely to lead to good results, since those supermajority rules solve or compensate for a lot of the problems that majority rule would produce. Okay, what do I mean by this? One feature of a good constitution is going to be that it's supported by a consensus. This is going to be especially important in a country like the United States, the pluralistic nation, where we use the Constitution to unify the country, where it's a source of allegiance. Right? Well, if the Constitution could be enacted by a mere majority of the people, then it would be possible, or a mere majority of the states, it would be possible for a strong minority to be strongly opposed, to be strongly opposed to it. And that would lead to significant divisions in the country. Not a good thing. By contrast, under a strict supermajority rule, you're much more likely to get a constitution that's supported by a consensus. Yet, of course, we don't just want a constitution that has consensus provisions. We also want one that has desirable provisions, right? One that is going to protect important rights, that's going to protect democratic decision-making. And one problem with majoritarian enactment of a constitution would be that it would be the problem we're all familiar with, partisanship. Right? So if you had majority rule, the majority party is going to have an incentive to enact provisions that further its partisan advantage at the expense of the public interest. By contrast, under a supermajority rule, you're much less likely to have problems of partisanship, because you're going to need members of both parties in order to support an amendment or the Constitution in the first place and therefore you're going to have much less of an issue of partisanship. Now, there are other reasons why supermajority rules would tend to produce desirable provisions. Let me just mention one of them. When constitutional provisions are enacted by a supermajority rule, and when you can only repeal constitutional provisions with the supermajority rule also, then they're enacted by a kind of veil of ignorance, a kind of way of we're not sure how they're going to operate or how they're going to affect us, right? So because the provisions last for such a long time, people are going to have a difficult time predicting how they're going to be affected by their provisions and how their family and eventually is going to be affected by it. And therefore, they're going to have an incentive to evaluate those provisions on a kind of more impartial perspective, which is going to make it more likely we're going to get desirable constitutional provisions. Now, these abstract arguments about the effects of supermajority rules have real application to our original Constitution. We owe some of our very most prized aspects of our Constitution, things we take for granted that we have pride about, we owe it to the supermajoritarian enactment of our Constitution, and most people don't even realize it. Take first the Bill of Rights, right? Had the Constitution been something that could have been enacted by a simple majority, it's quite likely that we would have gotten a Constitution without a Bill of Rights. It was only the fact that the Constitution needed to get 9 of 13 states that led the framers of the Constitution, that led the Federalists, to have to say, yes, we promise when you ratify this Constitution, we'll put in a Bill of Rights. A similar point applies to constitutional federalism. It's only because they needed a supermajority of the states to ratify the Constitution that the nationalists at the convention had to say, yes, we'll have an important role for states, what we call federalism. Okay, so these arguments don't only explain why our Constitution is a good Constitution, but they also support originalism. Why? Because the drafters and the ratifiers used the original meaning. They didn't know what Justice Brennan was going to say the Constitution meant. They didn't know what Justice Stevens was going to say the Constitution meant. They used the original meaning in deciding to enact the Constitution in the first place, in passing it through these supermajoritarian processes. So if we wanted to have the benefits that supermajoritarian processes confer, we have to give it the original meaning. We can't come up with some meaning that that people at the time didn't know about. Now, while using originalism to interpret a constitution enacted by supermajority rules is not a perfect method, obviously the real question is how does it do against the real alternatives, right? Is there a better alternative? And I think the answer is clearly no. Now, we can see that originalism is superior to having judges interpret the Constitution based on the living Constitution view, where they're essentially coming up with the constitutional norms on their own, by comparing these two processes, right? So for enacting constitutional norms. So under a living Constitution method, how do we get constitutional norms? 9 elite Washington lawyers decide what constitutional norms we should have on the basis of majority rule. By contrast, under the constitutional enactment and amendment provisions, which are in the Constitution, how do we get norms? A broad cross-section of the country has got to approve them in accordance with strict supermajority rules. To me, it's clear which of those methods is a better way of coming up with constitutional norms. Let me conclude, then, by discussing one possible criticism of the theory. It might be argued, well, you know, supermajority rules, there's something to be said for them. And maybe they led to a good constitution in 1789, but it's more than 200 years later now. And what reason is there for thinking that, you know, the Constitution is still good? Or, you know. And I think the answer is that there are very good reasons for thinking so. And I suppose one way of thinking about this issue is to think about what might be called the rate of decay of constitutional provisions, or how long they last and how quickly they are to get out of date. Now, if a constitution's well-framed, and we would expect it to be well-framed if it got passed through supermajority rules, if it's well framed, then the constitutional provisions are not going to decay quickly because the framers of the Constitution are going to have this issue in mind. They're going to say, ah, we need our constitutional provisions to last under changed circumstances. And the U.S. Constitution, I would say, has held up remarkably well, precisely because the framers understood this and they placed only the most important restrictions on the state and federal governments. Of course, in some cases, provisions are going to decay and they're going to need to be changed. And in most of those cases, constitutional amendments are going to take care of it. They're going to deal with the worst problems. But not all the time. We're going to have constitutional provisions which we can't get the requisite supermajority to eliminate, at least some mildly undesirable ones. And I think in the end what you have to acknowledge is that these are costs. These are costs, but they're costs that are outweighed by the benefits that this supermajoritarian process produces. And so we're better off with it, even though there may be some provisions in the Constitution which aren't ones we would choose to enact today. Thank you.
I read the paper by Mike and John McGinnis on an airplane last night, and if you're interested in this kind of thing, I recommend it to you. It's a very interesting and paper that and informative. I learned quite a bit from it. Somebody asked me at lunchtime, what's a former Jerry Brown aide counsel doing at a meeting of the Federalist Society? Todd kindly, in his introduction of me, didn't tell you about some of the skeletons in my closet, but I'm not trying to conceal them. Now, if this were a typical Federalist Society meeting, that would have been a silly question, as I'm sure the person who put the question would have realized, because as I'm sure you know, if you've been to any Federalist Society meetings, they are the home of, I think, the most substantive, the most rigorous, and the most balanced discussion of the leading issues facing the bar, facing the judiciary, facing the law, and facing the legal academy that you can find anywhere in this country. But it's a fair question at a meeting like this, because I am unquestionably the outlier among all the people on the program today. I did work for Jerry Brown during most of the time. I think that Ed Meese was advising Governor Reagan and President Reagan. I and most of the people I associate with just took it as obvious that a figurative part of his anatomy was a pair of horns. So why am I here? Well, one reason, and there are some people here who know me and who know that if I were to write an autobiography of myself, an autobiography, that a good title for it would be A Random Walk Around the Political Spectrum, because I always say I've never been a communist and I've never been a fascist, but it's hard to find a place in between that I've never occupied. One thing that I did a little before Ed Meese became an aide to President Reagan, I moved down to UCLA, and I have to say that I'm a little bit of a contrarian, and a few decades at UCLA will move a contrarian back toward the center if he's over on the left, and that's about where I am now. But in the last 10 or 15 years, I have had a few opportunities to meet Ed Meese at meetings, and at least on one or two occasions to have a fairly serious conversation with him. And I obviously, this is just a glimpse, but I must say that those contacts have been more than enough to give me a sense of, for example, what Ted Olson was talking about with all those qualities of good humor, intelligence, graciousness, and everything else that he said. And so I have to say I was in Denver. I went to Denver on Thursday. I was at a meeting yesterday. I came back last night, and I was thinking, why am I doing this? I could have stayed over another night in Denver. I had a nice dinner there and been more relaxed. But now that I'm here, I don't have have any second thoughts about that at all. It's a great pleasure to me to be with you as you honor this man who is so deserving of it. And I also would say that it's easier for me to say that, I suppose, because I've moved to the center of the spectrum compared to what I was then. But I think much more important than that is just with age, I've come to realize that political ideology is not a marker of character or of value in a human being. And I think we all make, certainly I have, and probably many of us make a big mistake when we act as if that is the case. Okay, now Gail Heriot is another person with many good qualities, one of which is generosity, but there is one flaw in Gail's judgment, at least. She has a tendency to invite me to appear on many panels, and surely a flaw that I can forgive, at least. I see it as a but perhaps it's not such generosity to the audience. But on this case, she said, we're having this panel on originalism, and my thought was, well, it's been a long time since I've been teaching constitutional law. I'm interested in this debate, but I'm not an expert in it. But then I got to thinking, well, it would be interesting to think about parallels between that debate and the debates that go on within the field of statutory interpretation. And so that's what I'm going to do. And it's really everything, almost everything I'm going to say is just a hypothesis. These are thoughts. I don't have the answers to these things, but I think there are some interesting facts. If we first take, let's say, you know, the theory of constitutional interpretation, if we drew a big circle and say, here's the space with all the theories that are out there and have some influence on the debate or on practice, probably if we had done that, say, in the early, mid-1970s, originalism or ideas akin to originalism would have been a very small part of that big circle, because of the efforts of people like Scalia and Mies and the Federalist Society and many, many others, and just the way things have gone in this country. That's become a bigger part of that space. It's obviously not the whole space. It may not even be half the space, but it's a substantial part of the space. Now, if we drew a similar circle around to identify all the different arguments that are made about statutory interpretation, there's a curious thing, and that is most of the space, not quite all of it, but most of it would be occupied by ideas that we associate with originalism. Now, if we go back to the constitutional circle, there's another interesting thing, and that is that within the space of originalism, there are actually differences, because originalism for some people or at some times has meant what we call textualism, and at other times or for other people it's meant looking at the intent of the framers, of the people who wrote the Constitution or the various amendments. In statutory interpretation, those same divisions occur, but they are the big controversial. They are not internal disputes within one camp. Those are the big issues in the field. Now, that strikes me as curious and interesting. Now, the standard way to divide up the approaches to statutory interpretation nowadays are to point to three. One is textualism, and you've probably all heard of that. And if we think about the politics of this kind of jurisprudence, textualism is to statutory interpretation what originalism is to constitutional interpretation. That is to say, in crude terms, that's the conservative position. And interestingly, both are very prominently identified with Justice Scalia. But the leading opponent of textualism, and probably the prevailing, the most influential idea in statutory interpretation, is intentionalism. What did the legislature intend? Which, in constitutional interpretation, is regarded as a part of originalism. It's a more or less conservative idea. In statutory interpretation, it's a liberal idea. Now, there's a third idea in Statutory Interpretation, and this one's a little complicated, called purpose or purposivism. And the reason it's complicated is because I think in the literature there are really two versions of this, and they're not always separated out the same way, and people don't always use the terminology the same. So it gets a little confusing. But one version, I think, just makes purposivism a nuanced difference within intentionalism, because people will say the intent is the specific meaning, specific idea that the legislators had as to what the statute would accomplish, whereas the purpose is the more general intent. So the specific, the intent might have been to increase the sentence for such and such a crime from 5 to 10 years. The general, the purpose, i.e. the more general intent, would be to reduce the crime rate or something of that sort. So that's one way these terms are used. I would prefer to say that's just the difference within intentionalism. There's narrow intent and there's general intent. If you follow the constitutional debates, you'll know that there's a similar debate that goes on. That should we be interested, for example, in whether the framers of the 14th Amendment, what their specific ideas were about whether that amendment would ban segregated schools, or should we say it doesn't matter what they thought about that. What does matter is that they were imposing a norm of racial equality, and that norm is inconsistent with segregated schools, whether they thought so or not. Their intent was to have that norm. Those are two ideas within constitutional interpretation, and those same concepts come into play in statutory interpretation. The other, and I think it's better to use the term this way, in other words, to have the two ideas within intent and then purpose is something different, is often one of the sources of this is the legal process idea, which is associated with Hart and Sachs. And the idea here is that instead of looking at the historical intent, what did these individuals in this legislature actually intend, let's take the statute and say, well, if a legislature passed this statute, what is the likely purpose of it? And I would say that, although this, for some reason this doesn't appear in the literature too much, I think it's really a reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person think this statute is intended to do, as opposed to what did those historical legislators actually intend it to do? Now, that idea is perhaps getting a little bit away from the core idea of originalism, but not that much, because if you look at Hart and Sachs, or if you look at the ideas that are usually put forth in the name of purposivism, usually it'll be said, you know, as long as the text will bear it. The general norm, I think, when people theorize about statutory interpretation is we really should try to understand the meaning of the statute. And then we have these different ideas of how to do that. Now, that's the theory. So you might think, well, gee, on the assumption that you are an originalist in constitutional law, you might think, well, the picture looks pretty good in statutory interpretation. There's only one fly in that ointment, and that is if you look at the results of cases, because it is easy to find cases of statutory interpretation that, by any reasonable account, depart as dramatically from any reasonable originalist account of the statute as you can find in constitutional law, cases departing from any reasonable account, originalist account of the Constitution. How am I doing on time? Should I be winding up? Okay, then I was going to give you some examples. I won't. If any of you are interested, I can curl your hair with some examples afterwards.
With a drink,
optional. Okay, so take my word for it that these examples are out there and they're interesting and that they are sufficient to make you, to drive you to drink. And on that assumption, I just raise this question. should we be so concerned with these theories? I mean, certainly we should, in the sense that they're interesting to talk about and they help us to understand the law and they help us to understand what's going on when we try to decide cases. But is this really the issue when we talk about restraining judges and having them follow the rule of law? Or, and this will tie back to what I said, I hadn't even thought about this, but it ties back to what I said before about my changing views of Ed Meese. Is this more a matter of character? And is it more a matter of some judges are going to do what they want under certain circumstances, and even if it's not what the law says? And other judges are more restrained and may use any of a number of different theories, but will conscientiously try to find what the law does. In other words, maybe not just in politics, but in judging and life, maybe character is at least as important or more important than theory. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank the Federal Society and Gail Harriet for inviting me to speak. Like Dan, I was a little puzzled why I was asked to speak here. I didn't work for General Meese when he was in the Justice Department. In fact, I had heard of most of you as someone hears about the earlier generation of pioneers. I graduated from law school during the deep, dark Clinton years, and so the idea that the Justice Department was against affirmative action, I mean, that's laughable to me, the idea that the Justice Department would be against the first affirmative action in the time I graduated from law school. So I realized my real purpose here was to bring greetings from Ed Meese's alma mater, which I saw was unmentioned by every single speaker, which is, and it seems kind of hard to believe, but General Meese graduated from the University of California at Berkeley. Both college and law school, I believe. That was back in the days when we used to fail one-third of the class. Today, as most of you know, the hardest thing about law school is getting in. But he went there during a very rigorous time for law school. It also, Ted Olson is an alumnus of the school. It's actually many of the great California conservatives went to Berkeley. And it actually reminds me of when I first met General Meese. I actually met him in 1995 when I was a general counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I went to introduce myself to him. And I said, I teach at your alma mater, Bolt Hall. And most people, most conservatives upon hearing this would react with pity, scorn, disbelief that there would be a conservative on the faculty at Berkeley. But, and this shows you a lot about Ed Meese's optimism, he wanted to have a conversation about all the other conservatives there must be there too. We had a very short conversation. And then we returned to the meeting at hand. I thought just one thing I would point out, two things in observation about this panel, which is about the success of originalism or the course of it after General Meese's speech on originalism. And those of you who are in law school or just out of law school, the second generation or later after the Meese Justice Department, you have a lot of fun with databases late at night with free Westlaw. So I started putting in all kinds of combinations of things into Westlaw to see what I could find. And one thing I found is after Ed Meese gave this speech about originalism, and you look at the number of times certain kinds of documents are cited in law review articles till today, and I thought I'd try to use something fairly over-inclusive, like just citation of the Federalist Papers. There are 800% more articles today in law review cite the Federalist Papers than did at the time General Meese gave his speech, which I think is remarkable, actually. I think is a product in some ways of the fact that not just the speeches but the appointments, everything you heard about today, made originalism so important. That doesn't mean everyone is citing the Federalist Papers agrees with them, but the fact that it's at least taken as such a serious source of authority, I think in a way it wasn't before 1985, as a mark. The other thing I found when I was playing around in Westlaw is that General Meese actually writes law review articles. He actually has, I believe, 8 or 9 law review articles that he's authored. I thought that was remarkable. Think about, can you imagine the idea of an attorney general today writing a law review article? I won't tell you the results I got when I put in Reno into the law review database. But the idea that attorney generals actually were intellectuals is, I think, something we've really lost in just a very short period of time. Now, that doesn't mean that I agree with everything Ed said, because I found some really crazy ideas in some of these law review articles. This one I particularly can't stand is, I believe that every law professor ought to take a sabbatical every 7 years and actually practice law for a year. You'd decimate the legal academy. And this is even worse. And then
what about the clients?
Well, it wouldn't be fair pay. No one would ever hire us. And that people ought to have a minimum of 5 to 10 years of legal practice experience before they can become law professors. So we can agree that even though you can write lots of law review articles, you don't have a great idea every time you put pen to paper. Oh, I can't imagine what this would have done. But let me just take two law review articles that General Meese wrote about in this area that I was asked to speak about, and sort of discuss a little bit what I've seen as a result of his arguments. The first famous, I think, law review, probably the most famous law review article he wrote, has a lot of citations even to today, is what he called an article he published in the Tulane Law Review called The Law of the Constitution, where he made the basic argument that it's not the Supreme Court's unique job to interpret the Constitution, and its views are not the supreme law of the land. That, in fact, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And I think he made a very what I would think of today, and I think that's a sign of how that view has prevailed, a conventional view, which we teach in the law schools, that this is the view of Marbury versus Madison. This is the view of Abraham Lincoln, has a long tradition in American history. At the time he gave his speech, it was wildly attacked as being an invitation to chaos. But I actually think today this is probably the conventional view of most people who teach constitutional law, and has actually produced more of the interesting scholarship in the legal academy. How I've seen that into practice, Todd asked me to discuss how I've seen that in practice, having worked in all three branches. I hate to say it, but I actually think the executive branch takes originalism most seriously of the three branches. As someone who worked in the Ashcroft Justice Department and the George W. Bush administration, for example, originalism did lead to some very important decisions. I think the most important one that you'd all be probably aware of is the Second Amendment. The Justice Department, in my time, issued a memo arguing that the Second Amendment is an individual right, and it was wholly based in an approach to the original understanding materials of the right to bear arms. And this was a view that was not popular with the Justice Department's prosecutors, the FBI, and so on, but it was a view of the department, I think, really driven by the conclusions you would reach from an originalist approach. I have to say, my time in the judiciary, I do think one thing that General Meese's speeches and the appointments to the judiciary did is that it started to force out certain kinds of arguments. I don't think originalism has by any means won. You look at the Supreme Court, I think just Scalia and Thomas are probably the only sure originalists. But take a look at the Brennan speech in your packets. It's impossible to believe that a Supreme Court justice today would write an opinion, a majority opinion, taking that approach to constitutional interpretation, where he basically just says this view of the Equal Protection Clause is the correct view because I believe as a judge at the beginning of the 21st century, my personal view is that human dignity requires that this be the conclusion. Today, even liberals on the court try to attach their findings and conclusions to the constitutional text or at least a precedent. You don't see these kind of free-floating arguments totally divorced from the text, I think, the way you did in the 60s and 70s. And I think that's another sign of the success that this argument had. I have to say, the branch where, and this is probably not surprising to those of you who've dealt with Congress is probably the branch I've saw in my personal experience where originalism has had the least impact. I don't give any examples. I was a general counsel to Orrin Hatch when he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and this didn't have to do with him, but I used to have to go around and brief senators about judges and sometimes about the constitutionality of bills. And we had two big constitutional bills during my time, a partial birth abortion bill and a takings bill. And I would always start out the briefings by telling the senators what we thought the original understanding of the power here or the constitutional right here was, and I don't remember a single senator being interested, and many of them laughing at me as I left the office. And that's not a surprise. I think while senators give the biggest rhetorical respect to the framers' understanding, it makes no sense for them to be originalists because all they'd be doing is limiting their own power. And I think Congress, Congress today, the last thing they're interested in is limiting their own ability to pass legislation that has, helpful benefits to their constituents. Let me conclude by addressing a second law review article that General Meese wrote, in which I feel actually quite bad. I hadn't read it before, and now I feel like a lot of my academic work is just a ripoff of his, and I owe him some royalty checks. He wrote an article about war powers in 1987, which said that the division of war powers between the president and the Congress is a political one. It's determined by politics. There is no legally right answer that can be adjudicated in court, that each of the branches has these powers, power of the purse, commander in chief, and the framers expected that the two branches would fight it out over war powers, and hopefully most of the time they'd agree, but lots of times they would disagree. And he just said they just work it out through politics. It doesn't go to court. I wrote a whole book making this argument, and I feel very badly that I didn't cite you. I actually do feel like I owe you a check because I claimed I came up with the idea, and now I realize that I didn't, and this is about 15 years later. So my apologies. But I think the interesting thing about your argument is, on the one hand, it's a different kind of use of originalism from the ones you've heard before. So often originalism is used to tie down the government's powers. And in this case, and I think it shows a sort of fidelity to the approach, not necessarily its results, is here originalism has the effect of releasing the powers of the government. It has the effect of untying down, or not untying, but unbinding the political interaction of the branches of government. Whereas people who are critical of war powers or critical of the president's authority in war have often used originalism to say there's only one correct way to go to war. Congress has to declare war. War powers resolution is constitutional. And so every war since World War II is illegal. And I think that's an odd argument, too. I mean, this is the one area I've found where people I would generally call liberals like John Hart Ely or Larry Tribe or Bruce Ackerman claim utter fealty to the original understanding. John Hart Ely wrote something, said, here the framers' intent is utterly clear, we must follow it, which is not the usual approach to the Equal Protection Clause or due process. Here, let me end by saying, how does the Meese view, I think, of war powers work out today in some of the fights we're having today, in particular the troop surge into Iraq? I think this is an interesting difference in how you would apply originalism. I think if you take sort of the convention, the liberal use of originalism in the war powers debate, they would say if Congress passed a law prohibiting the troop surge or passed a law saying the Iraq war is over, then it would be over, or it would be unconstitutional for the president to continue it on or to send the 20,000 additional troops to Iraq. Right? Their view is that Congress is the dominant power in matters of war because of the Declare War Clause. Again, as I sort of noted, this view, I think, is probably the majority view in the legal academy. It is a view that's wildly at odds with practice. So there have been many wars, particularly since 1945, that Congress has never authorized or supported. But what General Meese's view describes is what we're seeing today, I think, where you have the branches fighting between each other to determine the policy. Congress ultimately does have certain constitutional tools that it can use to stop the troop surge or to end the Iraq war. All it has to do is cut off funds, or actually not even cut off funds, just refuse to enact supplemental bills continuing the Iraq war at its current rate and level. And so one question is really that General Meese raises in his articles about war powers and originalism is we shouldn't find fault in the Constitution itself, when we see this kind of fighting, when we see a president moving ahead under congressional criticism, what we really are witnessing, I think he would say, is that we are witnessing a Congress that doesn't really want to exercise its constitutional powers. That Congress really can stop the Iraq War, as it did the Vietnam War, by cutting off funds. It may be a bad idea, but it can do it. And so when you see Congress passing non-binding resolutions about the troop surge or not, this is not really a constitutional conflict that everybody wants to see. You would really have one if Congress cut off funds and a president tried to disobey the funding cutoff. So let me just end there by saying I guess my bottom line message is from my time in government is that originalism is far more along than it was at the time General Meese gave his speech in 1985 or published his Tulane Law Review article in 1987. It has had a profound effect in the legal academy for sure, but it has had an important effect in the way different agencies of the government make their decisions. It hasn't, I think, become the dominant view, but what it has succeeded in doing is driving out intellectual sloppiness, laziness, or just outright sort of policy preferences disguised as constitutional interpretation. And I think for that we owe him, at least the generation that followed after, owes him a great deal of thanks. Thank you.
Well, I said we wouldn't keep you long between your drinks, but maybe one or two questions for this panel, since we started late, didn't we? Isn't that the does anyone have a does anyone else want to stand? No, we do have one person who wants to delay the reception. Sorry. Go. Okay, if I can rephrase that, the so-called desire of Roberts, if he were really to do that, but in fact, well, actually, I want to maybe open that up. Who wants to go? Oh, I'm sorry. John Roberts has said that he wants to decide cases very, very narrowly. I think the jury is still out since he hasn't issued many opinions, but what would that do, and is that a more originalist approach? Can you try to turn on the microphone?
Can you hear? Oh.
For recording.
Oh, for recording. Turner?
Is that working? Or do you want
hello?
To?
Hello? Okay.
I think it's better. Good. See this one right there? That's why we can't go into
thank
practice.
You. Is this working?
Yeah. We have to turn it on.
Oh, I have to turn it on. Just push on? Oh. You can see how.
I mean, my sons aren't here. They tell me how to do stuff like this. Okay, I like that question because I think it illustrates my point that there are different forms of judicial restraint, and originalism might be one of them. I don't think that taking the narrowest view of a case is necessarily dictated by originalism. It might be in some case, but it might be the opposite in another case. Those of you familiar with Alexander Bickel's book, The Least Dangerous Branch, which I think is one of the best books ever written on constitutional jurisprudence, I mean, the whole book is about that, really, is how narrow decision-making and other procedural sort of techniques can be a form of restraint. If I can just give one other example, if you take Justice John Marshall Harlan, the younger, and if I were asked that question that Ed Meese was asked, you know, who were the great lawyers or judges of the 20th century, I would have wanted him to be on my short list also. I don't think Justice Harlan was an originalist. He wanted to decide Griswold before the court decided Griswold in Poe versus Ullman. And whatever else you say about that decision, it's not an originalist decision. And yet, I think that Justice Harlan is almost a paradigm of a judge who was restrained, who genuinely tried to be and in large part succeeded in being restrained by the rule of law. I don't think narrow decision making is originalist, but I think that there are a variety of approaches that are not the same and may even be opposed in detail, but are in the same general camp because they reflect a basic orientation towards law.
Yeah, if I could just chime in. It's an interesting question because in one of his law review articles, Justice Scalia actually addresses this idea. He said, you know, I used to think that what judges ought to do is decide the case on the narrowest ground, but, you know, I now think that's completely mistaken. What we want to do is to state a clear rule and then follow that rule. And if you're stating the narrowest ground, you're not going to be able to state the clear rule. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, when you start to get more originalists, you're going to actually have disagreements among them, right? And you can see sort of the case for each of those approaches, right? And in a way, it sort of adds to kind of Dan's point about that in the end, a lot's going to turn on how the judges use them, you know, to what extent they have integrity and they're actually going to try to implement an original meaning through one way or the other. But
I would further support that. I would say first, I don't think Chief Justice Roberts is an originalist. I think if you look at his first term of opinions, he doesn't really mention it all that much and is more, and maybe like John Marshall Holland, he does seem much more driven by staying within precedent rather than, which is consistent with what you say. I agree. The second thing is there's no natural reason why originalism has to produce narrow decisions or broad decisions, or I actually don't think it necessarily has to produce judicial restraint or judicial activism. I clerked for Justice Thomas, and Justice Thomas is not one I would characterize as someone driven by theories of judicial restraint. He is someone who believes very deeply in originalism. But sometimes the originalism requires a broader judicial role. For just to take a small example, something General Mises was very interested in is the Fourth Amendment. Right? If you believe that the search and seizure clause is really restricted by whether the search is unreasonable, and that I think is the original understanding, you may get rid of the warrant requirement, but you still may have judges sitting there deciding what's a reasonable search for lots of searches, which may be a more active judicial role in some ways.
Maybe one more. There we go. Last word.
Well, let me just, the first one raises quite a bit of issues. Let me just give you a short version is the fact that, and I'm not sure I'm interpreting your first question correctly, but the fact that when the original Constitution was enacted and certain people, blacks, women, didn't have an ability to vote in that process is a serious defect. It goes to the very core of the argument. And I think, thankfully, that's been corrected. But it's a problem. The correct view of supermajority rules is to say that everyone would be part of that populace that's going to vote. Sorry. Oh, basically saying that if we had a majority enactment rule, we might not have had slavery. Maybe, although I think if we had a majority enactment rule in the North, who actually had slaves at the time anyway, but had they said, okay, we're going to abolish slavery, we would have had 2-3 countries. So, you know, it's a more complicated story. But let me get back to your second question. I don't want to be misunderstood as saying, and I often am, to be saying, supermajority rules are just great. Let's just use them all the time in every possible circumstance and in the same form. They make sense for constitutional enactment in one form, and I'm quite sure that, I mean, I'm confident at least, that they make sense there. I actually think they do make sense in the budget area, but not the form that the California rule has. And the basic problem there is if you don't enact something, then we close down the government and we got IOUs and we all have all kinds of problems. And I've got an article I won't bore you with now, but attempts to address that problem. So it's just a question of tinkering with the rule, and then we'll get rid of all that pork.
Thank you. And Gene, I don't know if you want to say any. Oh, yes. Oh, here we go.
First, thank you. Thank you for the panel.
I do want to thank all of our speakers here today. I want to recognize two people. Most of the people have been recognized today who feel special need to, but two who have not been are two Ninth Circuit judges we've had who've been here all day, Judge Dermot O'Scanlan and Judge Carlos Bea. And two other thank yous I want to say. Lisa Budzinski has done a lot of work on this conference to put it together. I hope she's in the room now. I'm not even, yeah, she is back there hiding. But thanks, Lisa, for all your hard work. And I do want to thank, although I mentioned it earlier, I do want to thank Gail Harriet again for, because this conference really was her idea, and she did an enormous amount of work in putting it together as well. So thanks to all of you for coming. We do intend this not to be the first. Hold on 1 second. This is we've essentially viewed this as our first annual Western Conference. We do plan to be doing this on an annual basis, either here or somewhere else in the West. And I thank all of you for coming. Our reception begins as of now. It's set up just in back of you. And thanks again.